Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. Sure. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, best-selling author of The Little Red Book of Selling.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute, and this is Sell or Die. Real-world sales talk, no bullshit, no tricks, just how to make sales, whether you're in Las Vegas or London.
Or some bullshit suburb of Las Vegas or London. Oh, we're interviewing the best minds of selling and personal development, and as always, we're taking your questions.
That's right. You can send them to us on Twitter at Gittimer or at Jen in a New York Minute. Maybe you want to email your question or maybe you want to advertise on this show. You can email those questions and inquiries to sellordie@gittimer.com.
Or if you have a carrier pigeon, send it to Charlotte, North Carolina. Well, people have carrier pigeons still.
Sure. Yeah.
Take this to your leader. How the hell does the pigeon know? It's a freaking pigeon. Anyway, another story. So, reading questions, are we... Wait a second. I don't read the questions. We have a glass behind the glass guy to read the question. The great, the wonderful, the one and only Doug Branson. Hey, Doug.
Hello, Jeffrey. Hello, Jennifer. A reminder to our listeners, you can listen to us live on Wednesdays at blogtalkradio.com/sellordie and make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Just search Sell or Die. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. Jeffrey, Jennifer, what's going on in your sales world?
What a nice voice, huh, Jen? Doesn't he have a nice voice?
I know. He has a total radio voice.
I know. Where are you, Jenny? Are you someplace in the world?
I am in Albany right now. Oh, my God. Heading to the Sagamore Hotel to get...
Well, that sounds pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
You're headed to the Sagamore Hotel. You faded out a little bit. Tell me where you're going.
Oh, I'm going to the Sagamore Hotel, and I'm giving a seminar there tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
It's a full-day workshop, actually, on selling and personal development.
Cool. Don't give the name of the client, because they may not want their name on the internet.
I know. I'm not going to.
And I'm here...
They're a pretty big client.
I'm here... I'm here in Charlotte, North Carolina, holding down the fort, talking to our employees, our customers, having a real good time today, signing books and booking deals. How about you, Doug? What's up with you?
Oh, listen, we're just producing this podcast and producing a couple of new things for the Gittimer Learning Academy. Mm-hmm. Those should be premiering in the next couple of weeks. So if you want more information on that, you should probably go to GittimerLearningAcademy.com.
I agree. Coming up today, we have an amazing show. John Stewart, the great, not the John Stewart, I'm asking him to write a book called The Other John Stewart, the CEO of Map Anything, an app, listen very carefully, the saving salespeople time and making them more money. He's going to stop by and talk to us about making tech sales easier or making sales by tech easier and making some salespeople nervous.
Plus, have you ever considered co-working an option?
Nope.
Well, you should now. Oh. It's becoming more and more prevalent as retail space price skyrockets. We are joined tonight by co-working expert Lisa Skyhane, who gives us some tips to maximize productivity in your space, whether you're co-working or working in a cubicle.
Cool. So let's get going. It's time to sell or die.
Yeah. All right, let's start with some sales questions. I picked this one for you, Jen, because you worked with Cutco. This comes from Reddit user LoneSeeker777. By the way, these Reddit users coming from reddit.com/r/sales, a great community for salespeople everywhere. LoneSeeker777 writes, as a Cutco sales representative, we're not allowed to door knock, solicit to anyone we haven't been recommended to, or otherwise be intrusive into someone's life. However, the exception is anyone who approaches me and knows what I'm selling and would be willing to buy. Now, recommendations are ridiculous. No one ever actually gives out names, either because they keep procrastinating, setting the date further off, or they flat out don't want to give out phone numbers. How can I generate leads on a low-key approach without violating the above rules?
I worked for Cutco, as you said, Doug, and I got every single lead of mine through asking for recommendations of other people they knew. And so it's hard for me to believe that these people are not giving you leads. And if they're not, you might be doing something wrong. I don't want to say it's you, but if it works for 98% of the other Cutco sellers out there, then there's something that you could probably refine in your sales pitch. And so one of the things I like to do was, if someone said that they were eating a lot of steak and so they needed steak knives, I would ask a specific question like, who else do you know might eat a lot of steak and might also need steak knives? And then I wouldn't just, because we had to have them, I don't know if it's the same today, but we had to get five names and have them write the names down on a piece of paper with the phone numbers. But I would ask, would you mind calling to give them a heads up that I'll be calling them so that they know that this is coming from you? And they were all excited to do it for me. I mean, obviously, I got a few people turned me down and said no.
You were a young girl. They were excited to do it for you. This is a guy who obviously has some sort of an attitude issue, or maybe it's disgruntled about the fact that he's not doing it. So, you know, you had an unfair advantage. You're a beautiful young woman. And they're willing to, you know, do anything for you.
Okay, so Jeffrey, you're a male. You have asked for recommendations in the past. What are your strategies for asking recommendations that actually get recommended?
Doug, I'm glad you asked that question. I'm going to tell this guy that he is looking for a sale and not a relationship or a customer. And if you're looking for a relationship with someone, they will gladly give you names. And if you're looking for a sale, they will never give you names. Cutco is a very intense business. They try their best to sell on a relationship basis. And obviously, the salesperson asking the question just needs more practice at being a relationship-oriented person and not going for the sale, but rather going for the customer.
It doesn't matter if it's a girl or a guy. You still have to develop relationships, and that's why I was successful at it.
All right, next question comes from Lowercase Capitalist. Lowercase Capitalist wants to know how to respond after giving a nightmare presentation. They work for a tech services company. They had a great one-on-one meeting with the retail director, but then they went to present to a wider audience, and the presentation had all kinds of tech issues. Slides didn't present properly. The tech demo that Lowercase Capitalist had prepared did not go well. Now they have to contact the retail director again, but they don't know what to say.
I would say it in a video and talk about and call this the big glitch. And talk about the fact that when something like this happens, it's embarrassing, and we probably have not earned your ability to be a customer. So I'd like a rematch or a retake or another opportunity to make the same presentation. You've lost. You're dead. But the only way you can revive is to have an error-free rematch. Jenny?
I agree with you on that one. I would just make sure with any video you send loads for them easily so that there's no more tech issues.
It sounds like a guy though, doesn't it? Just kidding.
All right, next question comes from In It to Schwin It. In It to Schwin It writes,
he's a biker.
We can guarantee you is a biker. All right, In It to Schwin It writes,
could be a girl though.
Or a guy. As salespeople, exactly. I feel as though we are always being contacted by recruiters. How long should one stay in a sales position before jumping ship?
Jenny?
If you're there and you're happy and you love what you do and you're making money and you wake up every day and you can't wait to get there, why are you going to leave? Just because some of the grass seems greener on the other side?
Yeah.
The recruiter's always going to paint a better picture. But if you're happy, stay.
There's a theory. It's called the rat's ass theory. The sales recruiter doesn't. The sales recruiter doesn't give a rat's ass about your career. He only or she only wants to place you to make a fee. So you have to do some soul searching, and if you're happy, I wouldn't even take a recruiter's call. I think that you need to be the best salesperson you can be. If you're the number one sales guy in your company, then you might consider looking. But until you're number one, stay where you are and get to be number one.
Is there any kind of stigma in the sales world about staying with a company a certain amount of time? Otherwise, you look like a jumper.
Not any different than any other company. I would hope you would have some longevity, but really what I'd want, I'm not going to look at that as your resume. You've only been there a year or two. I want to call it half a dozen of your customers and see how they love you.
Ooh, that's good.
I like that, Jerry. When I was hiring salespeople, I definitely looked at their mobility and how many jobs they had had, if it was a lot of jobs in a short amount of time, you know, and then I thought maybe that the company wasn't the issue, but maybe they were the issue. Yeah. So you don't want to send the wrong signal.
Yeah. Or to Jeffrey's point, if they've only been, it takes time to develop relationships. So if you're not at a company for a very long time, it's going to be less likely that you were able to develop a long-term relationship that led to multiple sales.
I agree with you, Doug.
Yep.
All right, last question for this round of sales questions. We'll do a few more later on in the show. Alf Kasperi writes, I'm 20 years old and just got promoted to a job in outside sales for a lighting company. Our target is primarily industrial and commercial lighting. I'm the youngest to ever hold this position at my company. What are some ways that I can overcome objections because of my age, whether they be explicit objections or implicit objections?
You take it,
Jim. Really,
you're the youngest person.
This happened to me. I was a really young salesperson and successful and kept getting promoted. And people, I look young still, I think, to this day. And so people automatically make a judgment.
Way to flatter yourself, Jen.
We'll be the judge of that.
You know what?
Pile on a couple more compliments.
So
the audience wants to hear.
I'm looking so young.
Are your nails done?
Of course.
Okay, good. All right, go ahead.
Okay. So I didn't mean that as a compliment. Anyway, you know, what I found was I had to overcome my own barrier of assuming that people didn't trust me or believe in what I was saying because I looked young.
That's exactly
And the way
right.
I was able to do that was by getting really smarter than the next guy about our products, our services, our value, how we help, what we do. And so that when I opened my mouth to speak, they were surprised by what came out because I wasn't saying something that sounded young, but rather something that they wanted to listen to because it was of value to them.
Do you remember that German sales guy that we met in Italy?
Yeah.
How young was he look? He looked like he was 12. But he was one of the smartest people I've ever met.
Yeah.
And if you give him 3 minutes to talk to him and you realize how smart he is, it's actually attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So you were right. Get intelligent. And by the way, you stayed intelligent.
Thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Let's get to our first guest, Lisa Sky Hain. She's the founder of Primary in New York City. It's an amazing co-working space, liveprimary.com. Last week, we visited her space and we discussed work aesthetics, wellness, and how it affects your productivity. She's a personal friend, colleague, I network with her, and she is the all-time guru on work wellness.
We're here today joined by Lisa Sky Hain. Lisa, thank you for joining us today.
It is my pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Is that a hyphen in your name? Is that a hyphen made in?
No, thank you so much for asking. Two words, no hyphen. I don't know why I have a thing with hyphens.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's prettier without the hyphen.
You know,
Lisa
Sky.
You kept your name, but you took your...
There's a backstory too. Sky is not my birth last name, and so I gave myself that last name, Lisa Sky, four letters, aesthetically pleasing. And then I married Hain, and I thought, oh my God, four letters. It's great. Don't put a hyphen and make it eight in one. Four alone.
That is amazing. I want to give myself a new last name.
So it's S K Y E.
S K Y E.
Yeah.
Lisa Sky.
Yeah.
Hain.
What was your original name?
Skokowski.
Now I got it. Okay. Enter Sky.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that was Gluckowski, and they shortened it to Gluckow. Well, I was would have been maybe better.
Over at Ellis Island there across the river, I was Zhytomyrsky.
Really?
And they shortened it to get him, were you? Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
Wow.
My grandfather came over, my great-grandfather came over on the boat in 1905, and he was... Henach
Zhytomyrsky. Wow. Wow.
You say that with such a good accent. It's like you know.
Like I know he came from the Ukraine? Yes, I do. But the a lot of people change their names.
Yeah, of course. I was in television, and I was an anchor, and my last name was Skokowski.
An anchor?
Yes.
A boat anchor? Or?
For PBS.
Oh, TV.
News
TV
anchor.
Got it.
And my producer always said I should change my last name, and I said, no, if people can say Christian Amanpour, they could say Lisa Skokowski. And my father and I used to joke about what I could change my last name to, and he said, you should be Lisa Summers, and you could say you're Donna Summers' secret love child out of wedlock. And I'd say, ha, ha, ha. And then I lost my father, tragically, in 2004. Wow. And the year after he died was very heavy, and I handled his estate. And if one more person at the end of that year said Skokowski, I was just done. And so the beginning of 2005, I was going back into television at that time. And I said, you know what? I'm going to make it easier for everyone. I'm going to shorten it. What should it be? And I thought Sky would be such an obvious shortening. And a friend of mine said, put an E on the end of it. And I said, oh, Lisa Sky, four letters, the aesthetically pleasing. Wow. And I put it at the top of my resume. And I went on my first interview. I walked in and I said, hi, I'm Lisa Sky. And there's an awkward silence. And I said, well, I guess if I want other people to get used to using my new last name, I should get used to using my new last name. And he said, don't worry, your secret's safe with me. Winked at me and called me in for the interview, hired me. And from there on set.
The rest is history.
I was Lisa Sky from there on out. There you go.
And what did you learn as an anchor besides being able to read well and look at the camera and pretend like you weren't reading?
Confidence. And I'll tell you that... probably there was potentially some of the start of what I've also really taken as a skill that's come into my life through my leadership in BNI, which is the ability to be present to what my thoughts are and to translating them into words and being able to speak succinctly in bites.
So it's networking, in other words, and trying to get to know people just to be able to communicate with them.
Sure, being able to speak articulately and succinctly, I think, in a concise fashion, as it were.
Almost speaking in tweets.
Yes, yes. Producers appreciate it immensely when you can speak in bytes.
So we're at Primary right now, which is your founding venture.
It's my other baby. I launched a baby that's
the
7 months old. Yeah, another baby.
With the other half of Sky.
Yes.
Correct?
Hain, Brian
Mr.
Hain
is Brian Hain.
Our chief wellness officer here at Primary, yes.
And I think that there is, you made the leap from being the queen of networking at BNI to the queen of co-working. What's co-working anyway?
Well, it's interesting that you asked me that word. I would say that the term co-working has actually been redefined because initially, 10 years ago when co-working came on the scene here in New York City in 2006, co-working by definition is a large group of people working in an open space together. But when WeWork came on the scene in 2010 and I was one of their founding employees, they redefined the term in that they created enclosed office spaces built with glass. And so you could be in a fully enclosed office, fully furnished, where you can turn the key, lock the door, leave your things behind safely. But when you look up at 10 o'clock at night, you could see that five offices down the hall, someone was co-working with you and that they were burning the midnight oil as well. So WeWork, I think, really redefined the term co-working. And co-working, especially when you have a glass aesthetic, can be about people coming together in a shared office space as well.
So why do people choose co-working spaces?
Well, I think co-working spaces for the small business owner are huge advantages for multiple reasons. The most obvious one is from a cost perspective. If you're a small business, the barrier of entry to taking an actual commercial real estate space is it's high because you're talking long-term lease, build-out costs, et cetera. So co-working typically, and even the more established long-term executive suite spaces, the HQs and Regises of the world, offer by comparison short terms, so 6 months, a year. But a lot of co-working models like ours are month to month.
Co-working aside for the moment, mm-hmm. you took on this venture. Mm-hmm. You have the predominance of a floor in a New York City downtown building by the Charging Bull.
How many square feet is it here?
We have 25,000 square feet
wow.
here.
Yeah, so, and which ain't cheap.
And I would want more, by the way. People often respond by saying, wow, that's so big. And I laugh and I say, I would personally want more. And I have a big theory behind why having more and being larger is important. I have, through my years of networking, also really become very fascinated by the subconscious of what happens for people. And I think that if people take office space in a space that is small, subconsciously, they may not recognize it, but they don't feel that there is an inherent ability for them to expand.
To grow.
Whereas, we're no community
yeah.
about them
exactly.
either.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. If the space is large, we're huge. We have tremendous opportunity for them to grow their business within our very walls. I think that adding greenery to the space was really key, and I think that we get tremendous positive feedback about the greenery. We read some statistic that if you look at nature for 4 minutes a day, it lowers your blood pressure, it increases your productivity. There's no question that people who come into this space say, oh, yeah, I specifically sat in the co-working room over close to that wall because I could just literally like feel the good energy of the plants coming off the wall. When people can't come into our reception and we have preserved live moss walls greeting them, people have said, oh my gosh, I've been wondering how I could make an enclosed space that has no windows feel really great and enjoyable to be in.
I'm sure you had challenges to take 25,000 square feet and turn it into offices. You have this fantasy of what's going to happen, and then the reality sets in when some general contractor gets the plans.
No doubt. There is so much pressure right now for me, technically, to make this business succeed. Someone entrusted me with millions of dollars. One person, an individual investor, gave us millions of dollars. It's an extraordinary privilege is how I ultimately feel. Someone has given me multiple millions of dollars to create my dream, and it feels like a big responsibility, no question. And there have been a lot of bumps already in the road. Our construction was delayed 2 months. Really, we have often felt like it's a comedy of errors. There have just been ridiculous things, like all of our sliding glass doors have silver bindings at the top that came from China. We were 26 short. We called China. They stopped manufacturing them. Are you kidding me? We can't hang doors on offices without these parts. I had to have a custom metal person that I know from my former networking group re-jury-rig new metal pieces. You know, like just really random things have happened like that throughout this opening. I will say that we have spent a bit of money on attorneys in situations where I've felt afterwards that maybe a conversation with the person direct could have gotten us to a more positive result instead of spending thousands of dollars on legal fees. I hate to say that because I have many, many attorney friends, and I do think that there are many times and places that attorneys are appropriate. That's been one situation. We have had, admittedly, issues with our contractor and subcontractors, and they're still outstanding today. And so I'm not even sure what the resolutions are to those.
I would think that when you're starting a business like this, that you make this master plan, then you get down to the detail of things that you weren't thinking about, like who's going to polish the floor and who's going to run the last bit of wiring to make sure that everything's approved. I mean, there's a thousand things in this place. As you just look around, mm-hmm. it's unbelievable.
Right. We can't control the music from inside the IT closet that is in our conference room because we can't go through a meeting every time we need to adjust the music in the space, for example, that needs to be based by the reception. Oh, but wait, there's not appropriate power in the reception. So, oh, wait, we have to have an electrician come back again. How long will that take? How much will that cost? Okay, another 3 weeks before that's done. Oh, the glass on the studio doors came in and it's cut too short. We have to reorder all of the glass. Oh, the glass came again and, oh, whoops, they forgot to frost the glass. So now the entire studio is going to be open. Wait, we have to go and get the glass for the third time.
One thing I've noticed about you, Lisa, is that you're always positive. I don't know what's going on in your head and if you're thinking positive, but the construction's delayed, that this is happening, that is happening. And talking to you, you wouldn't feel the frenzy that might be going on around you. What would you recommend to our listeners? We have a lot of people who are salespeople who are listening and business owners. And what are some of the strategies you employ to stay positive?
Well, I happen to be fortunate because when you do, you know, the Marcus Buckingham Strength Finder test, that sort of thing, one of my top five strengths is positivity. And I don't know, call it, maybe you need an appointment with my mother or something. And my mom is uber positive as well. And, you know, the woman who would call me and say, good morning, you have the power to create miracles in your life. Have a great day. And like, that would be my voicemail from my mother.
Oh, that is so cute.
I don't know. You know, I think that I have certainly taken some courses over the years where I have been able to learn to take myself down a mental path of playing out the worst case scenario. And, oh, well, what if this fails and then that fails and this fails? And then I'm in a cardboard box on the street with my husband and my adorable 7-month-old son, Henry. And if that happened, I love them both so much that that wouldn't be such a bad thing. And we all know that that wouldn't happen anyway. So
no.
I think you use logic to think it through and saying.
Sense to be over top of the grate where the subway goes, see that heat.
Yeah, exactly.
And a little wind when the subway.
There's a lot of subway
through.
Rats. I hear, you know, roast them over a fire or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, one of my best girlfriends also gave me a quote I hold very dear, near and dear, which is just because you can't see the big picture doesn't mean there isn't one. And so to kind of have the ability to kind of zoom out, mm-hmm. so to speak, and see the big picture and see that just because in this moment, this day, this hour, this week, whatever it is, things aren't going the way that I planned. Try to shift the thinking and remember that it's happening for me and not to me. Don't be a victim, but rather a volunteer who chooses to see that there's an opportunity in here somewhere, and it's up to me to find that opportunity. Where's the learning opportunity?
That's so powerful. Accepting responsibility to take it on.
I'm going to be 40 yeah. next year, so I can't say that
what?
I've had...
Oh,
I've,
I, no I, way!
You don't look a day over 39.
Oh, stop, Jeffrey, stop. I can't say, you know, I've always had these philosophies at the forefront of my mind, but certainly as I get older, they're right there. And I will tell you that launching a massive company challenges you in every way that you possibly can. By the way, my new hot tip to everyone is if you want to ever make having a baby seem easy, launch a massive company at the same time, and the baby will seem very, very simple, because having given birth to Henry in December and then opening primary in May 1st made Henry seem very easy.
So what you're saying is if you're looking for calm in an entrepreneurial startup environment,
have a baby first.
Yeah.
Exactly. Get pregnant. Have the baby, and then launch the business.
Note to self.
Yeah.
It will put everything in perspective for you.
Okay, so a lot of salespeople are going, especially in New York City, and just nonstop client, and tons of stress, trying to meet quota, selling. How does health and wellness play a role in this space and, you know, in the life of a productive, successful salesperson or business owner?
I would bet that if you...
Who is helter skelter to start out with?
Right. I would bet that if you ask the most productive and successful salespeople what their daily rituals are, and I'm sure that they have them, a lot of them start their day consistently with some sort of type of meditation, exercise, something that's related to centering their mind, their focus, and their ability to be productive. And so that is why we created Primary in a nutshell. We wanted to be able to give wellness amenities and the tools that people need to take care of themselves, because we believe that if you make your primary focus caring for yourself and your body, everything in your life, including your business, can thrive. And so we've given small business owners the tools and the amenities that the Facebooks and Googles and Bloombergs of the world have given to their employees. Small business owners now have those amenities here. They can take care of themselves. They can be busy salespeople, but they can take that 15-minute pause in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. They don't have to sacrifice 20 minutes to get to the gym, 20 minutes to get back. They can walk 30 seconds down the hall, take a quick class, save themselves 40 minutes that they're closing another deal in that day, in that time.
Thanks again to Lisa Skyhane for joining us. You can learn more about her fast-growing co-working space at liveprimary.com. Jeffrey, what's your best work aesthetic look like?
A window that faces the Statue of Liberty.
That's a pretty good one.
But that's what do you like specific. To have?
Yeah, really.
And good coffee.
What do you do when you're in Charlotte?
You look out the window, but you paste a picture of the, of the Statue of Liberty on your window. And say New York, 584 miles, which, by the way, they make it 584 miles so that American Airlines can charge you two upgrade tickets instead of one.
But you like to have a lot of stuff on your desk and around your desk, right? That's kind of your thing?
Me?
Yeah. In terms of your aesthetic, what does that do for you seeing all that stuff?
I like to keep things that I'm working on top of desk so that they stay top of mind. But Jen... is in more of a neat freak, so I have to keep my crap on my side of the table. But I can reach under papers and
space.
I can find cookies and pretzels.
You know, when we walked into Primary, one of the things that I loved about the co-working space is that you get there and the entire desk is clean. So there's no clutter, nothing to clutter your mind. You just sit down. There's the only thing on the desk space is electrical outlets and... you're free. And to me, that's a very peaceful working environment. But then they add the greenery and all this stuff that makes, you know, that's just sort of there. And you don't know it has a purpose that makes you calm and makes you work better and be more productive and all that. And it just, to me, that's a perfect work aesthetic.
A weird thing with me and my work aesthetic is that I really have to change my desk. You've probably noticed, Jeffrey, I've changed things around a little bit. Like, I have to move things around. It's like if I get in a rut, you know, creatively, if I change some things around in my environment, it helps me to be more productive.
Oh, that's cool.
So
I don't change things around. I just fill it up with crap. So it looks different every day.
That's another strategy.
Yeah, but Jeffrey, you put things on the wall that are inspiring to you. So that when you're writing and you look up and you see these things that are inspiring, I mean, talk about that. That's cool.
Well, my work aesthetic in my library, because I'm a writer, I surround myself with things that inspire me, whether it's a Eugene O'Neill first edition or a Napoleon Hill signed first edition or some art that was created by my high school classmate or something that I purchased, just anything. I'm inspired by that. You know, I try to create my own memory space or my own stream of conscious so that I sit down and smile and I sit down and want to work or want to write. And I'm, you know, I've been a writer for 25 years. I can say honestly that I have never sat down at the computer and A, not had something to say, and B, not be on fire about it. Like, I'm happy to be a writer. I love it. So I guess part of the secret of aesthetics is if you don't love what you're doing, it doesn't matter what's around you.
That's true. That's true.
Well, part of the aesthetic here in our studio is this giant Death Wish coffee flag.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about Death Wish coffee, Jeffrey?
Death Wish coffee is the world's strongest caffeine coffee. I describe it as, if you're bald, this will make hair stand up on the inside of your head.
They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee. We drink it. and you should too. So go get your first bag of the world's strongest coffee at deathwishcoffee.com.
And if you're listening and want to sponsor our show and reach thousands of motivated listeners, email us at sellordie@gittimer.com for more information.
Yesterday, we were talking with John Stewart, the CEO of Map Anything. It's an app that fuses with Salesforce to help you cut out all of the wasted time when you're out on a sales call or your appointment gets canceled or you have time in between calls. Time that you can use to make more sales. Now, we discussed a variety of subjects with John that you'll hear over the next couple of weeks. This week, we talked about his fascinating background and thoughts on the implementation of tech in sales and how they improve and enhance the selling process. Take a listen.
Well, I'm actually an engineer by degree, and I started in the aerospace and defense industry. And my first sales-ish job was I was a sales engineer or a demo jockey for McNeil Schwindler Corporation or MSC Software. It was high-end engineering software. And I did that for about a year and a half. And, you know, I was of the opinion that I got tired of making my sales guy's number for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is not that hard.
Exactly.
And so I, when the opening opened up, I wound up moving to Atlanta to take a sales position with MSC Software. And that's how I basically transitioned from engineering into sales. And really haven't looked back since because I've did a few different things with the the dot-com era and internet security and enterprise IT sales, and then opened up my first company more or less in 2003, 2004. Selling engineering services, a space that I knew both in, when you're a principal in a company, a small business, the first thing you better be able to know how to do is sell yourself, right?
Exactly.
Everything else is secondary to that. Got to be able to bring in revenue.
How did you make the transition from the logic of being an engineer to the emotion of making the sale?
Well, I was fortunate in that the product I was selling was high-end structural analysis software. It was, $25,000 a seat. And since you were selling to engineers, you better knew how, you had to know as much as they did about that area, or you weren't going to be able to sell these people on them. It was a very technical sale. So in that case, it was a fairly easy transition. So really, it was a matter of basically just picking a few different skill sets, doing a lot more listening than talking, right? Obviously. When you're the sales engineer, you're trying to be the smartest guy in the room. When you're the sales guy, you're not. You just want to be the highest paid guy in the room.
Yeah, right. That's so interesting.
It was just more of a shift in attitude more than anything else. And then it was, I moved from there to doing enterprise IT sales, and that was a different animal. That was far more relationship selling. That was far more going high, wide, and deep, as the expression goes, you're running multiple threads in a sales process. And I did have to learn a whole different skill set for that.
Did you learn it automatically, or did you take classes? Did someone teach you?
Well, I did have a mentor, a guy by the name of Joe Noonan, who is actually now the CEO of VI Labs. And so I learned a lot from him. He had been doing enterprise IT sales for, 20 years. He was a great mentor in that type of transition. So very, very helpful, in doing that. But, I never actually took any formal sales training per se. Well, that's not true. Back at MSC Software, they bring in experts from time to time and they do the, a Saturday at a club or whatever to, at a hotel to, focus selling or this selling methodology. I'm sure you've seen them all.
I have actually. Was there anything in any one of those courses that you took that said, oh my gosh, this is where I got to be?
No, I mean, I knew I wanted to kind of do the sales thing, right? Once you got a little bit of taste of it, once you mm-hmm. close your first deal, right, you got a taste of it, you never go back, right? So it's like getting your first kill.
Once you become the highest paid guy in the room, you have to stay there.
You try to, right? And it becomes a, for sales, I've interviewed in my career now hundreds of salespeople, right? And, you know, and I asked them the same question, why are you in sales? And there's only one question, you know, one answer I'm looking for, and it's, you know, I like money. And that's the correct answer. But then after that, it's, you know, competition. You want people that are competitive. You want people that, and so there is a competitive aspect to it. Absolutely. There becomes a point where it's, you know, it's scoreboard, right? You know, and those are the reasons, you know, and that's what kind of what we look for. But, you know, that's also the reason that I probably, you know, did that as well, which was obviously there's no better way to up your earning potential than doing sales, and certainly the competitive aspects of it. And then obviously, you know, bringing a solution, especially when you have a solution you believe in and a solution that works, you're bringing that to a company, helping them solve some problems. There's always, it's very rewarding.
So tell us a little bit about MapAnything.
Sure. So MapAnything, what we are is a we are a Salesforce. First of all, we're a Salesforce ISV Gold Partner. Now, what that means is our product is built inside of Salesforce.com and is marketed on the AppExchange, right?
Only at Salesforce.com?
Only at Salesforce.com, right? So we do have some systems that are built on AWS, but they currently only serve the Salesforce.com ecosystem as well. So, you know,
it's a pretty broad market.
Fourth largest software company in the world. You know, you hear different things about the number of logos. I've heard the number as high as 300,000 individual logos. So it's plenty of, it's a plenty big enough ecosystem. And Salesforce is sometimes hurt by their name, Salesforce.com, but they're also field service. They're also help desk software. They're also marketing. So it really is just basically a business automation platform. And so we're an ISV partner. We started out as a systems integration partner building custom solutions. But what our product does is, it just like the name, it lets you map any Salesforce data on a map. It's route planning, it's schedule management, it's you know, it's a visualization tool. So, you know, I've got this approach or philosophy about basically data, which is, you know, the world of big data, we have it all thrown at us, like gobs and gobs of it. As human beings, it's really actually hard for us to digest. But this concept of a map-centric, mobile-first type interface is something we've been socialized to already. Now, I haven't looked at your iPhone at all. And if you were to turn it on, though, I'm willing to bet that you have Facebook, Uber, OpenTable, Google Maps, or the equivalent Apple Maps on there. And I haven't even seen your phone. And you probably do, right?
Yep, every one of them.
Of course, and Waze.
And Waze, yeah. Of course, yeah. Right? So
I like Waze because it tells me what's on the side of the road.
That's what I like that too.
And it can tell me in a British accent.
I like that too. But if you think about it, then you've got a mobile business platform where it's map-centric. So the where of things matters. And so
and how to get there.
How to get there.
Not just the where is it, but like the shortcut or where the traffic is. I mean, it's refined.
But also what you got to think about is in context, right? So if you're searching for Italian restaurants on OpenTable, right, that's in context of where you're standing and what's nearby and the reviews and all of that. So our approach is pretty much the same thing. It's here's where I'm standing. Show me what's, you know, nearby and what we call them layers of whether they're contacts, leads, accounts, prospects, custom objects of any sort. And we present that in a way that's easy for them to consume. And more importantly, we present it in a way that's easy for them to interact with it and capture data. So, you know, we're trying to reduce the amount of time they spent doing data entry, which they hate doing. Like, people hate doing the data entry, which ultimately is going to help the company with their adoption. And we're trying to reduce the amount of time they spend driving or planning because that gives them more time to sell, right?
Correct.
So, you know, that's kind of our philosophy of our product and or the approach we go to market with. We try to say we're the where of things for Salesforce.com.
So what I learned from going to the Sales Machine conference is that there are so many hacks out there, like Jeffrey said, that I never even knew about. How do you think this is changing the game for salespeople?
Well, for the people that really, really adopt it, and we have studies from some pretty large financial institutions with thousands of users on the street. When I say really adopt it, it means they use it to basically plan their day or their week, and then they use it to exception handle in the field. And so that's a technical term for saying, my appointment just called me and canceled last second. Now what I do with this extra 2 hours before the next one, right? You know, for the people who really adopt it, you know, they can see a 30% to 40% an increase in the number of appointments they can get in the field in a week. Now, if they're any good at their job, that should translate to more sales and more commission checks. So, you know, it's a matter of whether or not you buy into that philosophy of, you know, this approach.
I think we could take a rule right now and change it. when you ever hear someone say that sales is a numbers game. And in my old day, I said, no, it's a smart numbers game. And I think now it's a tech numbers game.
Mm-hmm.
That if I'm done a sales call and I can call up on my map or in my software package who's around me and who might be a good prospect for me, and I can see that it's going to take me 7 minutes to get there if I walk, or I could take the 5 train and get there in 3 stops, or I've got to drive 20 sure. minutes to get there, whatever the deal is. I can call that guy on the phone by hitting the – I can. I don't even have to dial his number. I can just tap it, and the number will pop up, and I go, Bob, I'm coming over. So I think that there's also – the sales guy can get – from your software, the sales guy can find out who's there, but then he also still has to know how to sell, correct?
Of course. All we're doing is helping them to get, you know, to get those appointments, those meetings. There's no substitute for sales skills, right?
I haven't found one yet. I don't. You know.
Not yet. I don't think we will ever.
You can show them. I mean, you can help them identify. That's the thing technology can do, right? Technology can help them identify the opportunity or the best ones to go to.
Mm-hmm.
What it can't do is it can't turn basically reduce every single sales process to order taking.
That's correct. And otherwise, my granddaughter could take over. And she's a lot cuter than your salespeople.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. We wouldn't even need your granddaughter, though. You could do it with a website, right? Yeah. That's what Amazon is. It's sales ordering writ large.
Boom.
And so, but there's going to be no replacement for the sales skills. So what we do is, I mean, what we've tried to do with our platform, and there's other technologies that we're now looping into it, so you can actually cross your Salesforce data against external data sets to then basically contour or color them or rate them by you know, call it, you know, people call it different things, but really it's, you've heard this before, propensity to buy models, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to basically take all that big data, intelligence and AI and external data and all the volume that gets thrown at someone, and we try to get it down and reduce it to green, yellow, red. Which one do you think you should go call?
Mm-hmm. I'm going green.
Exactly. So,
okay, but this is my challenge question to you. How has that affected the guy that used to do it the old way?
Well, the guy who's doing the old way because he, quote unquote, knows his territory or he knows what he's doing because he's done it, he's actually putting himself out of a job, because the next generation of kids, those millennials we were talking about,
mm-hmm.
they're smart and this is the way they're doing it. So they're replacing, they're substituting 25 years of sales experience for maybe they're not as good in front of the person face to face. But guess what? They have the technology which has supported them to make sure they're in much better face-to-face appointments, and you know it's being served up in context, whatever information they need to be able to close that deal. You know, they're going to put themselves out of a job.
Jen, you're the leader of a B&I group that features a lot of young salespeople, but you also have some members who are a little older. Are you seeing that there's a divide between young salespeople and, you know, the iPhone generation and the older salespeople who are from the flip?
It's interesting the way you ask that question, because I am seeing a divide in the world in some ways between some of the people who may be a little bit older and more reluctant to take on all the new technology. But I will say, for the most part, in my networking B&I group, I have hustlers in the group. I have hard working people in that group who are keeping up with the time. And maybe they're just, you know, all attracted to the same group of people, but it doesn't matter the age in that group. We have pretty varied age ranges from 20s to 70 something. And they are on smartphones, they are on computers, they are totally tech savvy. I will say what I have found, and Jeffrey, you started to point this out to me a little bit, and now I'm noticing it a whole lot more. The older generation picks up the phone way more easily. And so when I pick up the phone now to call someone, people are surprised. I got called out in the meeting for trying to set an appointment by calling someone rather than emailing them. They thought that was the coolest thing on the planet.
Right. Right. It's like, I'm going to send you a Google Calendar alert. Please open it up and click on it. I wonder if we took our whole list, we have several hundred thousand people on our Twitter list, and we sent them all Google meeting alerts. I wonder how many would just accept it out of hand. We could have like 100,000 people in one meeting. That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
That would be cool. Yeah. We could just invite them to the podcast.
We'd crash it in the U.S. in one shot. But I think, and this is just from my personal experience, people who are 50 and older, maybe even 45 and older, are much more reluctant to get into the process. They're not going to tweet. They downplay it, or they'll tell you they don't understand it, or some other kind of crap like that. They don't understand.
They have some excuse. I agree with that.
Yeah,
I do.
They think testimonials need to be a letter instead of a video, and they're not with it. And they're losing to somebody who's younger than they are, and they're pissed off about it. Like, dude, you don't have to be pissed off. You could jump in the game and play. It's free.
Yeah, but it's okay. So you're a 50-something-year-old and you're a 22-something-year-old. You're both selling the exact same thing, and you both have the ability to – you work for two different companies, but you both have the ability to use Map Anything. One uses it, one doesn't. Who's going to win?
Well, that's for sure, but one's going to pick up the phone and one's going to try to email, so the older guy's going to immediately have a competitive advantage by the virtue of the fact that he gets the lead and is going to call the guy. If they both have that Map program, the millennial is going to email the guy.
That's true.
The sales guy's going to the older sales guy's going to call him.
What if the person is reluctant, one of the people are reluctant and not using the technology, the tools at their fingertips, they're going to lose whether they're picking up the phone or not. Because you can't compete with that kind of technology if you're not using it too.
No, I totally agree with that. So you have to be more tech savvy, and you certainly have to pick up the phone. So if you can do the combination of those, you're going to win.
We're back live next week at our regular time, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Bookmark blogtalkradio.com/sellordie and come join the conversation that's revolutionizing sales podcasting.
And thank you to our guests, the great Lisa Skye Hayne and the other John Stewart. Thanks to our great, amazing, unbelievable producer, Doug Branson, and our technical director, Chris Hill, who I can't even see because the screen is blocking the way, but I'm sure he's there. And
he's great, too.
Oh, he's amazing.
Until next time, I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, reminding you, telling you, challenging you to get out there and sell until your ass falls off.